When Chris and I visited New York City, I think it was about 11 years ago now. Yeah, 11 years ago, we made a point in New York City of going to a Sunday Mass at the famous St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. How many of you have been to St. Patrick's before? Yeah, in the massive church in New York City, and where lots of famous weddings have happened there. Chris had been there before when he had visited New York City, but I had never been there. I had never really spent any time in New York City, and I was interested to see this historic place. I always love to visit churches wherever I go, and I wanted to see this historic place after hearing him rave about how beautiful and spectacular it was. When we arrived, though, the entire sanctuary, we were so disappointed, the entire sanctuary, the whole thing was covered in scaffolding. Scaffolding everywhere throughout the sanctuary. They were undergoing a three-year, $177 million renovation project that year. And so it was all covered. We stayed for the Mass, but I can't say that I came away raving about its beauty, right? Fair enough. The scaffolding had been put there to do a very important job, but it did not look pretty, and that's not why it was there. Imagine for a moment, though, put on your imaginations and imagine that the contractors had put up an absolutely dazzling display of scaffolding, right? Scaffolding made out of precious metals and gems and adorned by beautiful artwork by famous painters. And imagine then that the tourists would come day in and day out, not for the church, but for the scaffolding, right? And they'd come and they'd bask in the beauty of the glorious scaffolding and take pictures with it to put on Instagram. After a few months, it would become all about the scaffolding, and everyone would forget that there's something far more impressive underneath the scaffolding. Eventually, the renovation finishes, though, and everyone is saddened to hear that the scaffolding is coming down. People have come to consider it a work of art in its own right. The contractor, though, insists on removing it. It's just scaffolding. It was there to do a job and then be dismantled so that the ultimate reality, the real St. Patrick's Cathedral, could be seen in all its glory. That image can give us a sense of what is happening in the last couple of chapters of Revelation. Humanity has come to see the scaffolding of creation as what's of ultimate importance. And while it's beautiful and wonderful in so many ways, it's still not as impressive as the full splendor and glory of God. In these verses, as we near the end of John's vision, John writes that he was carried away in the spirit to a high mountain. In literary tradition, mountains are a place where people go to get closer to God. Now, we know that you know, God is not up there and we're down here, that God is everywhere and that, but it's this image of going up on a mountain to be closer to God. Mountains always have tended to represent what we know as a thin place, right? Where the curtain between heaven and earth becomes a bit more transparent and mortals may mingle a little more closely with the divine. Jesus himself is said to have withdrawn to a mountain when he wanted to pray. And of course, the mountain was the setting of the Transfiguration, where Peter, James, and John were able to observe Jesus' conversation with Moses and Elijah. On this mountain, then, John is shown a heavenly new city made of precious metals and gems, the proverbial streets of gold, which are, as you guessed, symbolic, right? They're not literal streets of gold. In this tradition, gold is the most precious metal that they could think of. So in writing, it's always been that way, that gold is the most precious, and it's used in the homes of the most powerful kings and rulers then as it is today. So of course, in their minds, when people were writing in that literary tradition, only gold would be worthy to describe how they would imagine God's city. And so as John is having this revelation, he sees everything is made of gold all around him. But we shouldn't be expecting from that literal streets of gold in heaven, because being in the presence of God is even more glorious than gold. And that's what he's saying here. In verse 22, which Felicity read for us, where we might expect to learn that even the temple was made of gold, so the streets, we're waiting to hear that the very temple is made of gold, we learn that there actually is no temple. And that would have come as a big surprise to John's readers. Part of the suffering that the early Christians were facing, at least when it came to the Jewish Christians that John was addressing, is that they had been banished and cut off from the Jewish synagogue and temple life. As Jews, the synagogue was central to their community life, and the temple was the center of their whole religious life. The whole of Judaism focused on the temple. It's where God himself actually resided. And now, as Christians, they had become cut off from the temple, from God's very presence. They would have been hoping for a vision where they were readmitted to the temple. That's what they would have been expecting, is that this victory would include a readmission to the temple that they'd been banished from. So they'd been persecuted by the Romans, and they'd been cast out by the Jewish temple leaders. And to them, it was like they had been cut off from the sun. But John writes to them that in the vision God has given to him, the new heavenly city has no temple. In fact, it also has no sun and no moon either, which would have taken them from shock to a state just beyond human imagination. That's nonsensical. There is no sun or no moon. I mean, it's incomprehensible to the human mind. Is there anything more indispensable to life on earth than the sun? But in the new heavenly city that John sees, even the sun is superfluous. In the new city that's revealed to John, the things that people saw as the very foundation of life, from the temple to the sun, the things they've counted on with their whole being, that they consider indispensable for existence, are nothing more than scaffolding that's going to be taken down. If we go to the mountaintop with John, we get a very different angle from which to view the world. And so this passage offers us a radically different view of reality as well. It points us to the reality that all the things of earth upon which we place our dependence, the things that we consider to be the foundation of our lives, are impermanent and ultimately unworthy of our absolute faith. And that can be really hard for us to get our heads around. We know it on a basic level, right? We get that our clothes, our appliances, our furniture, even our cars and other possessions, they don't last forever, right? They gradually wear out and need to be replaced. But even more important parts of our lives, our jobs, our relationships, none of these things are eternal. Each of us probably knows someone who dedicated their life to a career and a company only to be blindsided when they were out of their and downsized out of their job in an age when it was difficult to find something new. Our most treasured relationships in life are not eternal. We can't cling to them for our eternal hope. They're not our saviors. Our parents, as we know, grow old and die, and I found that hard to get my head around because I had never known a world where they didn't exist, and I know many of you can relate. Throughout my life, they were the one constant. Circumstances changed and people came and went from my life, but they were the one constant. Family members and friends often fall out and become absent from our lives, and new people come into our lives. As adults, spouses often become our grounding relationship, right? They replace our parents, they become our foundational relationship. But married couples, even if they persevere and stay together through all of the challenges that a married couple can face over 10, 25, 50 years, will one day see that foundational relationship broken up by death. One out of every two married persons will have to learn to live without that one person they always could count on. So who? So what can we count on, right? Surely we can count on the sun. We have faith that the sun will rise each day because it has done so every single day for millions of years. But even the sun is not ultimately dependable because one day, who knows when, probably millions of years from now, but eventually the sun too will burn out and be no more. Even the sun, which makes human life on earth possible, is not eternal. It's a created thing, just like you and I are. Have I depressed you enough yet? I don't mean to. It's not meant to be depressing. It's the truth, right? It's reality. And if you think about it, I actually don't find it depressing. It's a ground of hope because it's the truth about the earth that points us beyond the scaffolding, right? Beyond the scaffolding to the greater hope that we have. The hope that we have that transcends all of the other things we put our hope in. As the Apostle Paul wrote, if we have hope in this life only, then we are most to be pitied. But John is telling us that we have a much, much greater hope, a hope that is eternal, a hope that will never fail, that will never pass away. Now, I'll be honest with you, I haven't always found it easy to get my head around the idea of looking forward to heaven, right? Because quite frankly, I like my life. I've met lots of people throughout my years of ministry who have spoken so joyfully about looking forward to heaven one day, but I can't say I've always shared their enthusiasm. I like being with my friends and family. I enjoy going out for a delicious meal, right? And I find joy in the beauty of nature and art and music. I feel a sense of purpose in the work that I do. So I confess, I'm busy enjoying the scaffolding, and I'm not in any rush for it to come down. My dad's health and quality of life got to the point where he could no longer do all those things that he enjoyed all of his life. And I suppose I can see how at that point one might find it easier to look forward to heaven, right? That's when you turn your hope towards heaven, but that's not what this is. The hope we have in Christ is not just for later when the scaffolding of earth has started to deteriorate. In fact, the hope that we have in Jesus Christ is not that we'll have a good life here on earth and then when we die we'll go to heaven. The hope that we have, as we see in these final pages of Revelation, is that as much as we can find joy and beauty in God's creation in this life, it's all scaffolding. And there's something so much more amazing that will one day be revealed to our eyes. Under the scaffolding, kingdom work is being done here and now. And one day God intends to reveal the true and perfect beauty of what he intended the earth to be at creation. He intends to finally reveal a whole new earth, but also not just a new earth, but a whole new heaven. We tend to think of heaven and earth as separate. One is perfect already and the other not so much. But according to God's plan, heaven and earth are a unified part of his glorious kingdom. And when the scaffolding comes down, we'll see that the two are eternally joined together in a perfect union. These verses in chapter 21 then contain many images that are symbolic, but they give us the best image that our human imaginations can handle of what God's new creation, new city, new heaven, new earth will be like. You may be wondering, yes, but why are the temple, the house where God dwells, and even the sun and the moon, which are indispensable for human life, why are they absent from this new city? Because in the imminent presence of God, these things are not just dispensable, they're redundant, right? John tells these outcast Christians that when God completes the renewal of heaven and earth, the physical temple on earth will become redundant. Though they have been cut off from it now, they simply don't need it, because the true temple, the eternal dwelling place of God, is now found in the lives of men and women who are committed to Jesus. It's there right now. It's there right now, not just later, after we die. And there is no need to enclose the divine presence within stone walls. It will come to pervade the whole city. In God's kingdom, there is no night, no darkness or shadow present for hiding, so no sun is necessary. We sing in that great hymn of faith, "There is no shadow of turning in thee," because the light of God illuminates every corner of the earth. In 22 verse 1, we read that the river of the water of life that John sees, and we read of it, and it is significant because throughout the biblical narrative, rivers have always served as obstacles. They've always been obstacles to God's people, but in God's kingdom, they're not a barrier. Rather, they too contain the life-giving presence of God. In 22 verse 2, we see that the garden that was the beginning home of humanity is again a shared dwelling place, restored by God to his original intent for creation. And we are in mutual relationship again with God and with all of God's people and creation. The tree of life, the tree that had been forbidden to Adam and Eve, is now given for the healing of the nations. We see that everything from Genesis to Israel to the prophets to the incarnation, death, and resurrection of Jesus, all of it has been pointing to this reality of God fulfilling his eternal purposes in creation. Pervading all the images is a sense of permanence, dependability. This has been God's plan all along. The new creation of God is indestructible. We can count on it. When the scaffolding is taken away, the true glory of God will finally shine through, and we'll wonder what we ever saw in the scaffolding all along. Now, there's an ecclesiological significance to all of this. And by ecclesiological, I can usually say the word. Ecclesiological means having to do with the church, right? The ecclesia, if you know French, église, it's all that word. So it has to do with the church. And John's churches would have understood that ecclesiological significance. And it's important for us too. The New Jerusalem is a metaphor for the church. The new creation is a metaphor for the church. And in the church, we already have the opportunity to participate in the new heaven and new earth that God is creating. And by the church, I don't mean a particular building or denomination, because those two are scaffolding, right? But the church universal, which is unseen by the eyes, but exists already right now, wherever the hearts of believers are inclined to follow the path of Jesus Christ and find their eternal identity and hope in Him. The church, of course, is made up of imperfect human beings and hasn't always done things well. But the church, when it's at its best, is a glimpse of God's new creation, where God is the center and the source of life and brings each one of us closer and closer throughout our lives to Christ-likeness as we follow Him and trust in Him. The church is a part of the new heaven and new earth. It's a part of God's eternal plan. N.T. Wright puts it this way. He writes, "The whole of Christian theology is based on the goodness of creation. Yet the goodness in creation consists partly in this, that it points beyond itself to a new creation. It isn't the case that the new creation is an afterthought, a plan B once the first creation had gone badly wrong. Human sin has meant that God's eventual design had to be arrived at by a long and often tear-stained and blood-spattered route, the most important tears and blood being that of God Himself in the person of the Lamb. But as with the triumphant conclusion of Exodus, so with Revelation, the goal is achieved by the power of sheer mercy and grace, the mercy and grace through which creation is not abolished, but fulfilled, not thrown away and replaced, but renewed from top to bottom. One day we'll see past the scaffolding. And that's not a cause for sadness, that is our hope. It's the moment when all of the painful aspects of human life will be defeated, and the full glory of God will no longer be hidden from our eyes. Our hope is not in the things of this world. Our hope is in God alone. When people, life, institutions, including the church, have let you down, remember, it's scaffolding. God will never let you down. Amen.